Welcome, everyone, to the Apocalary Podcast. I'm Steve. He is...
Larry Van Beek.
Ah, we did it differently, folks. We're trying to catch you unaware, you know, just keep it fresh, keep it real, you know. here we are. We're talking about Revelation 7. And we're going to go through... we're talking about the 144,000, talk about some great multitudes. We got it all this week, Larry. Like there's multiplication, there's math, there's discrete math. That's right. We didn't even have to use a calculator. We were tempted, but hey, we get to go to the four corners of the earth even. So yes. Anything you want to say about Revelation 7 before we get started, bud, or should I just jump right in?
No, just jump right in, Steve. Read maybe the first four verses.
Okay, as usual, folks, I will be reading the ESV once I switch to it so Larry can see the ESV. And
this is NIV stuff.
That's okay. There we go. I'll freely admit I'm going to butcher some of the words that are... I don't think that was a Freudian slip, by the way. If it is, my Freudian slip is showing. That's my mom's old joke, and I got to use it. So anyway, let me read 1 through 4. Again, we're reading the ESV, chapter 7, verses 1 through 4. After this, I saw four angels standing at the four corners of the earth, holding back the four winds of the earth, that no wind might blow on the sea or the earth or against any tree. And then I saw another angel ascending from the rising of the sun with the seal of the living God, and he called with a loud voice to the four angels who had been given power. given power to harm earth and sea, saying, "Do not harm the earth and sea or trees until we have sealed the servants of our God on their foreheads." And he heard the number of the sealed, 144,000, from every tribe of the sons of Israel. So, hey, good thing you and I are in that 144. We're good, right? Like, the rest of them are all screwed.
Oh, well, unless there are 144,000 Jewish evangelists, then...
Oh.
Then we may not be a part of that group. Now this chapter 7 is what we call an interlude, and it's answering the question that we finished with in the end of verse 6.
Right.
Who can stand?
And right. Now okay.
7, and he's telling us who can stand, right?
Okay.
And we did say that if you're a post-tribulationalist, this could be referring to the sealing on the church so that they're protected. Just okay. The way Israel was protected in the land of Goshen, the Christians could be protected through the tribulation. So it starts off, after this I saw four angels at the four corners of the earth. This has nothing to do with a flat earth theory.
Good.
with ships falling off the edge of the earth and sea monsters and stuff. It's very common to refer to the four corners of the earth. We still do it today, from the four corners of the earth. I heard one person say from space there are four major edges of the earth that you can see, but I don't believe that either. So
no.
I think it's just an expression.
Yes.
And so these four angels are holding back the four winds on the earth, that no wind can blow on the earth. Now look at here. He says earth or sea, and this time he doesn't say under the earth, but he says or against any tree.
Yeah, odd, eh? Like
a little bit odd. Different, yeah. And none of us really know why he says against any tree, or there's always someone who thinks they know why.
Yeah, right.
you'll always get that. But the guys that I read, by the way, the one of the main commentaries I will use or I will recommend. If you're not heavily into the languages and you just want someone who's pretty good on Revelation, is Leon Morris.
Okay.
Which I just realized that you are Stephen Morris and he is Leon Morris.
Yes, and by my lifestyle, you can see that I'm living off the book prophets that he. No, actually, I'm not no relation at all to Leon. Yeah.
No. But Leon does the Tyndale New Testament commentary series, and it's a very good little commentary. If you're working through the book of Revelation.
Okay.
But he thinks that the against any tree really has to do with the fact that it's a wind. And one of the things that a strong wind does is blows down trees. He thinks that's why John picked up on the winds.
Okay.
Or on the tree there. And the four winds of the four earth that the angels are holding back, if you read in Zechariah, the four horses in Zechariah are the four winds.
Oh, okay. Good tie-in. Good tie-in.
Yeah, kind of a nice tie-in, you know. And I haven't heard anybody refer to the Holy Spirit here at all. So we're thinking that this is calamity, that these angels are holding back the calamity, right? And they're waiting for something. They're holding back the calamity until something can happen. And then there's an angel who rises from the east. He rises from the sun, so he's rising from the east. And he has the seal of the living God. Now, this is different than the seven seals. Those are the seals on the contract, right?
Right.
That are going to be open for us to read. This seal, we are pretty certain from here and again later on in chapter 14 that this is a seal of protection.
Okay.
Yeah, so you're going to get marked by God to be protected by God. And then he calls out to the four angels who have power to harm the earth and the sea. Now, this time he doesn't say trees. They're just harm the earth and the sea. These four angels, he says to them, don't harm the earth or the sea. And now he says trees again, or trees, until the servants of God have the seal on their foreheads. Okay? So the servants are sealed on their forehead, and that is the protection from God. And again, I said, if you're a post-tribulation rapture person, then what they're saying is that God's people are sealed to protect them through the tribulation. So that's the idea behind there. For me, there's a little bit, there is something else going on here as well. But anyway, so that's the whole idea of these angels. Notice the angels are totally controlled by God. There are going to be angels holding back in a little while, and it'll says God kept them for this very moment, hour, and day. In a few chapters, we're going to be reading about those angels. These angels are being held by God. Every time that God has something going on the earth, he's got total control of what's going on. And God is in total control here as well. He's in control of his angels. His message.
A and almost like a purpose, a direct purpose is given to each angel for a certain period of time or an event or whatever you want to call it.
They've got these really good jobs that they get from God.
Maybe just to double back, and I mean, I'm sorry if I'm holding this up at a point here, but maybe just for me, just to realize that the audience that John is speaking to probably is pretty well versed in the Old Testament, right? Because he makes all these allusions to Old Testament passages, you know, brings up similar themes, all those kind of things. Larry, would that be fair to say?
Yeah, I think so. Now, here's the thing: is you're in Asia Minor, and so your church is going to be made up. There could be a lot of Gentiles in your church as well, right? There will be Jewish people. They had synagogues through those places. When Paul traveled through, he stopped at the synagogues. These are the synagogues of the dispersion. You remember when Israel went into captivity in 722, 721 BC, and then Babylon took over Assyria, and then Judah went into captivity to Babylon in 605 to 585. 585 was the end of that. The Jews were dispersed all over this land.
Okay.
And that was actually probably the rise of synagogues was that.
Okay.
When you could get 12 Jewish men together, you could have a synagogue.
Okay.
I think it was 12. It might have been 10, but I got 12 in my head, so I'm going to say 12. And then there were the rabbis were the traveling ministers. So there would have been Jewish people in all of these churches. And of course, the Bible of the church, right up through the first century, would have been the Old Testament. Probably the Old Testament as we know it. They would have used that Pharisaic canon, the Torah. The Torah is the first five books, and they would have used the Law, the Prophets, and the history books, the writings, the Law, the Prophets, and the writings.
I
struggled with that for a second.
Oh, no worries. It was, I think the first version of the Message that just came out around then. And
Patterson, was it Patterson who wrote the Message?
Yeah.
Patterson was just getting that done. He wrote on Revelation, by the way. He wrote a book called Reverse Thunder.
Oh.
And yeah, people said it was great.
Never seen it. Okay.
So anyway, now John, so he hears the people that are going to be protected, right? And
yep.
He turns, and it's not turning yet. He hears the people that are going to be protected. He hears 144,000 from every tribe of the sons of Israel.
Okay.
So now, if you want to read 5, 6, 7, and 8.
Let me read 5, 6, 7, 8 then. 12,000 from the tribe of Judah were sealed. 12,000 from the tribe of Reuben. 12,000 from the tribe of Gad. 12,000 from the tribe of Asher. 12,000 from the tribe of Naphtali. Sorry, I knew I was going to say it wrong. 12,000 from the tribe of Manasseh. 12,000 from the tribe of Simeon. 12,000 from the tribe of Levi. 12,000 from the tribe of Issachar. 12,000 from the tribe of Zebulun. 12,000 from the tribe of Joseph. And 12,000 from the tribe of Benjamin were sealed.
Well, thank you. And Zebulun sounds like one of the poor Ford cars of the past.
Yeah, or it should have been in Guardians of the Galaxy. You know, like that was one of the monsters they ran into. Oh, Zebulun.
beware of the Zebulun.
Yeah, that's right. And yeah. Actually, pre-show, folks, we were pretty sure that Issachar, we were like, wasn't that a movie title? And we came up that was Ishtar was what we were thinking of.
Yeah,
so.
That movie with Warren Beatty.
Yeah.
I don't know much about the movie, so I don't want to comment on it.
Yeah, I know. Apparently it was horrid.
Really or
Yeah.
So, anyway, Steve, do you notice anything about the tribes here that seems odd to you?
Well, yeah, and it was only because, you know, you and I were talking about this before, but, you know, as you raised, Dan is missing from this list, and Dan, you know, was one of the tribes of Judah, you know, back in the Pentateuch, right?
Right. And so, and here's the thing about it. My father-in-law, when he would do his study of Revelation, he often talked about the 144,000 Jewish evangelists that rise up during the tribulation period. And they go out and they spread the word of God throughout the world. And then, of course, because he saw a rapture before chapter 6, then he would say, then people would become Christians. But because the Holy Spirit was the restrainer that was taken away, it would be totally by their will and their cognitive decision that they accepted Christ. Mm. And it would be these Jewish evangelists that were traveling around the world. Now, it's not a bad concept, but where I struggle with it a little bit is because of what you just said. Dan is missing from this. Hmm. The tribes of Israel were usually mentioned in one way or another. Sometimes they would mention Levi when they talked about the tribes. And when they mentioned Levi, they always mentioned Joseph, right?
Hmm.
And that's when they're talking about, well, generally I would say about spiritual Israel. And maybe that's a bit of a misnomer, but let's go with that.
Sure.
If they're talking about the division of the land, they wouldn't mention Joseph or Levi, but they would mention Manasseh and Ephraim, because Manasseh and Ephraim were Joseph's two sons.
Right.
And remember, Joseph received that double portion, and therefore two of his sons got land. Okay. Yeah. And so there was two different ways of dividing the land, but what they've done here is he's mentioned Manasseh. Then he's mentioned Levi, and he's mentioned Joseph. So there are a number of issues with this, right?
Right.
If you're going to mention Manasseh, why not mention Ephraim and leave Joseph out?
Right.
If you're going to mention Levi, then why would you say Manasseh and not Ephraim? Now, there are some who feel that Manasseh is actually, it doesn't work at all. Because it kind of only works in English, I'm just realizing. But anyway, there's some that say, well, he put in man instead of Dan, and so then they translated it as Manasseh, and so that's where the error came. But that doesn't work for me at all. I really think that what was happening here is John left Dan out because Dan was the tribe that caused Israel. They were the sinful tribe. They sinned quite badly.
Right.
If you remember Jeroboam, after Solomon's reign, his son Rehoboam took over the kingdom.
Right.
But he took bad advice from the young counselors, according to the story. And And because of that, he only kept two tribes. He kept Joseph and Benjamin, which became Judah. And a guy named Jeroboam, he got the 10 tribes, which became Israel. And that's the period of the divided kingdom.
Right.
And Judah, what's his face?
Jeroboam.
Jeroboam. He could have done very well with this, but what he did, because he was afraid of people going back to Judah, to going back to the temple, he started his own priesthood made up of anybody that he chose at the time, and he set up altars in Dan in the north, right, and Beersheba in the south.
Right.
And so Dan became the place of sin. There was a view that the Antichrist would come out of Dan. There was a little bit of a view like that.
Okay.
And so you wouldn't mention Dan in a spiritual talk. So Dan is left out. So, but it also suggests, though, that if you're going to, with all of those kind of things going on, that probably this doesn't refer to national Israel.
Mm.
Because if it's national Israel, you know, whether you like Dan or don't like Dan, Dan belongs in national Israel.
Right.
If it's spiritual Israel, well, then that work, that fits into, you can do just about anything you want with it then, right?
Right, right. And
so that's
and,
that's the whole idea of the 12 tribes here.
Okay.
So for those that are very literal about it, you do have issues, right?
Yeah. Because you've got John playing fast and loose with something that, but yeah. But there's a point trying to be made by this list, right? It's just.
Well, now it depends on where you go with this, right? I think there's a very strong point that's being made. And if you'll read 9 and 10.
Okay.
And 11.
Let's do
and
12, it.
Yeah.
Okay. I got that. Okay. After this, I looked, and behold, a great multitude that no one could number, from every nation, from all tribes and peoples and languages, standing before the throne and before the Lamb, clothed in white robes with palm branches in their hands, and crying out with a loud voice, "Salvation belongs to our God who sits on the throne and to the Lamb." And all the angels were standing around the throne and around the elders and the four living creatures. And they fell on their faces before the throne and worshiped God, saying, "Amen. Blessing and glory and wisdom and thanksgiving and honor and power and might be to our God forever and ever. Amen."
And do you remember in chapter 1 and then again in chapter 5, I said John does this thing where he says something, and then he says, in some it says, "I turned and looked," but in this one it keeps saying, "After this I looked." So he says something to create an expectation, and then it says, "After this I looked," and then what you see isn't what you were expecting. So in chapter 1, he saw the vision of Jesus. That, you know, "After this I looked and saw the vision of Jesus." Then in chapter 5, you hear about the lion of the tribe of Judah, right? Right. The root of David. And when he looks, he sees a lamb as if it's been slain.
Mm.
So you're expecting to see something powerful, the lion of the, you know, and you look and you see a slain lamb. Well, this time, he does the same kind of thing again. He mentions the 144,000 from the 12 tribes of Israel, messes up the tribes just a little bit, but when he turns, he sees a great multitude that no one could number, from every nation, from all the tribes and peoples and languages, standing before the throne. So he's talking about the people of Israel, and when he turns, he sees everybody. And most of us that see it the way I'm about to say think that, again, what he's doing is he's using Jewish language to talk about the church. Remember, all the authors have to deal with that issue of Christians coming from Judaism and everywhere else coming together.
Right.
And non-Christian Jews and Christian Jews are separate now, and all the Christians are together. And that's what he's doing here. So we think, right? So we think that these people that are getting sealed, they're not just Israel, but they're from everywhere. They're everywhere.
Right.
They're everybody. They're all Christians.
Right. Oh yeah. And then, like you and I were talking about before, he interchangeably uses both symbolism, and then he's oddly general, right? You know, he could have used a symbol for a great multitude, but no, he just said a great multitude was there, and flips back and forth.
Yeah, that's a good point, Steve, because he's so specific. You know, 12,000 from each tribe. 12,000, 12,000, 12,000. Ah, it's everybody. It's just, you know, there's a pile of people out there.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
And he does pull that together. So this ceiling seems to be for all of the Christians.
Right. 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 And then draws on some things that they might have known about Jesus too, right? With palm branches, that kind of bringing in that triumphal entry, that kind of thing into Jerusalem, right?
Yeah, when they were bringing the king in, they did the palm branches before the donkey, you know? And I remember when I wrote about this once, talking about, you know, Jesus didn't come in on a great stallion. He came in on a lowly donkey. I was completely wrong. My teacher pointed out, no, Larry. The kings in Israel rode in on donkeys. So when Jesus rode in on the donkey with the palm branches, he was very much saying, yes, you thought I was a king. You were right. I really am. I really am a king.
Yeah.
Which is kind of neat. And then here they have the lamb, right? Standing before the throne with the lamb. And these guys are now clothed in white robes. We're certain this is the clothing of righteousness this time, the clothing that Christians would wear. Yeah. And they've got palm branches crying out in a loud voice, salvation belongs to God who sits on the throne.
Yeah.
And to the Lamb.
Yeah.
And again, pulling Jesus into your view of God there as well.
Yeah.
And then, we got to keep going here, right? And the angels are standing around the throne. Sounds like they're standing around the water cooler somehow. There. And the angels are standing around the throne and around the elders and the four living creatures. But look what they're doing. The angels are all falling on their faces, and they are worshiping God too. And don't forget, these angels, when you see an angel on his own, the temptation to worship is overpowering, right?
Right.
And the angels will say, like, don't worship me.
Right.
And here they are worshiping God, all these powerful.
Yeah. Just another sort of vision, like from chapter 4, right, of everything bowing before him at that point in time, or at least everyone before him bowing before him.
Yeah, it's one of the weird things about this book is that he keeps dragging you back to heaven and showing you what's going on around the throne.
Yeah.
You know, how much is this church suffering? Like, what are they facing right now that they need to continually hear about the throne? Fantastic drama. You know, if you're standing there after supper listening to it, it's a fabulous drama.
Okay, you want me to read 13, 14 or go
even further? Do that.
Okay, 13.
Yeah.
Okay. 13, folks, that's where we'll start then. Then one of the elders addressed me saying, who are these clothed in white robes and from where have they come? And I said to him, sir, you know. And he said to me, these are the ones coming out of the great tribulation. They have washed their robes and made them white in the blood of the Lamb.
Yeah, so there you go again. So one of the elders is talking to him, right?
Yeah.
And the elder says to him, and usually it's angels that do this. This time it's one of the elders says, who are these in white robes and where do they come from? And I said to him, sir, you know. And this is a literary ploy. Now, John very well may have seen this, but it's something, if you remember the Transfiguration, they see Jesus go up in a cloud.
Right.
And the angel standing there turned to them and said, what are you men staring at? You know?
Yeah.
And they go, we're staring at Jesus. Like, what do you think we're staring at? Jesus going up in the cloud, man.
Yeah.
Like, get in the game. And it's a literary ploy because the angels are able to say to them, look, he's going to return in the same way that he left, right? And it's a chance for the gospel writer to say, look, this is the future. This is what's going to happen. And John does the same thing here. The elder asks him, you know, who are these that we're talking about in their white robes? And I said, sir, you know. And then he says, these are the ones who come out of the great tribulation. They have washed their robes and made them white in the blood of the Lamb. So I'm talking about the great multitude being the Christians from every tribe, nation, and language.
Yeah.
Right? They're compared to the 144,000 Jews who are going to be sealed. In my mind, he has just confirmed that at this point.
You
know, who are these ones that are going to be sealed? Oh, well, they're the ones coming out of the great tribulation.
Ah, right. Right. He's tying that all together at this point. I get you.
To pull that back to chapter, to the sixth seal with the saints under the altar.
Yep.
When they cry out, how long before you avenge our blood? A little while till your number is fulfilled. He looks and he sees this number from everywhere and they're given white robes.
Yeah.
And my father-in-law would again say, they're martyrs in the tribulation.
Okay.
Where I just see this as pointing to all Christians.
Okay. Okay.
And they've washed their robes and made them white in the blood of the Lamb. And of course, our righteousness comes through Christ dying on the cross. Mm-hmm. And that's why we live their white in him. Go ahead, Steve.
Well, Lair, does this give like some credence to the fact that, I mean, so many times people want to drive a linear sort of view of Revelation through the book, whether they want to or not, or whether it's really there or not. But isn't this John kind of jumping around all through visions at this point in time? Because, you know, no matter, I guess, where you'd be, well, I guess, you know, if you're pre-tribulation, this is the end of the tribulation, right? The saints are there. Now it's time to start getting on with the destruction of the earth.
Yeah, and you could see it that way, right? Or if you're seeing a 7 years tribulation, because you can do this, you can make this work all the way through this book. And, you know, people have spent 100, 150 years making this work really well. and again, that's okay. But they're still going to see this as there's stuff going on the earth, but this is a vision of what's going on in heaven. Like it is a glimpse of what's going on in heaven. No matter how you do it, this great multitude, they're in heaven. But of course, if you're a dispensationalist, this 144,000 can easily be these Jewish evangelists that are on the earth after.
Right.
Okay. I'm just saying that what he's pointing at here, in my mind, is he's just talking about the Christians and the suffering of the Christians, and that's going to come up, you know, four or five more times, calling for patient endurance on the part of the Christians, on the saints, right?
Which is why you see the church all the way through this book, right?
That's why I see the church all the way through, yeah. And don't forget, you can still be very literal and see the church all the way through. That just makes you a post-rapture, post-tribulation rapture.
Yeah, yeah.
Like George Alden Ladd. And he's my only example of that. He's the only one that I know that actually goes that direction.
Okay.
There are others, but he's the one that comes to mind all the time.
Yeah, yeah. Okay. So why don't I read then from verses 15 through 17, and we'll go from there.
That sounds perfect. Yeah.
Therefore, they are before the throne of God and serve him day and night in his temple, and he who sits on the throne will shelter them with his presence. They shall hunger no more, neither thirst any more. The sun shall not strike them, nor any scorching heat. For the Lamb in the midst of the throne will be their shepherd, and he will guide them to springs of living water, and God will wipe away every tear from their eyes.
And to me, that is the end of time. Right? You know, that he's bringing that. They're before the throne of God. They're serving God. God is sitting on the throne. He's protecting now.
Yeah.
You know, we don't experience this a lot in this country. There are people who do, but this whole idea of hunger and thirst and being out in the scorching heat, that may not be something North Americans experience so much. I remember once I was in Florida as a kid, and I was wearing a tank top, and I started burning, and I couldn't get out of the sun. So, not exactly this expression, but it was very painful.
And so, right.
So, you know, I have a very minor view of what this is about.
Right. Yeah. Right. But like you said, you know, as you went back and said about the throne, of why does he keep calling them back to the throne?
Yeah.
They must have been experiencing something so horrid that they needed this vision of the throne as comfort.
And I believe that, I believe some of them were, anyway. Remember, the Laodiceans weren't.
Right.
But some of them were.
Yeah.
They were facing it. Yeah, it's a good point, Steve.
Yeah.
For the Lamb in the midst of the throne will be their shepherd.
Yeah.
It's kind of a cute little twist on words there, isn't it?
Yeah.
The lamb will be the shepherd.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
Sorry. And instead of the shepherd guiding them to living water, there's the lamb is leading them to living water. And we tend to quote the last half of 17 all the time, right? You know, God will wipe away every tear from their eyes. So.
That's right. And the concept there, of course, is you know, you're a church going through incredible suffering. You're experiencing pain and loss, and the tears that you cry, I'm going to remove those. There'll be, they talk about no more crying in heaven. My father-in-law used to say, he actually felt there was crying in heaven because God had to, when we saw how poorly we did on earth, we might be crying about that, and God would remove that pain from that. Yeah. But I see this more, this is talking about the struggles on earth are now gone.
Yeah, right? Yeah, that pain and sorrow that we carried with us.
Yeah, and remember, this is an interlude, and what chapter 7 just answered was the question, who can stand, right?
Right.
When the mountains are falling on people and the rocks, and they're crying, they're actually crying for the rocks to fall on them. And in this, who can stand? Well, who can stand? Those that God seals. God's children can stand through them.
Yeah.
It's quite nice, actually, I think.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, like you and I almost joked, right? It's kind of like the bridge, you know, we've sang a couple of verses. This is a nice bridge off to the chorus. And we're about to hit that seventh seal and that pause that we'll talk about. But is there anything else that we should clean up in this, or are we all ready for chapter 8 next week?
No, I think we're ready to move on.
Okay. Yeah.
There's always lots you can say.
Yeah. Yeah. But unlike, you know, some of the more painful preachers we've listened to in our lives, we're not going to moan and groan on for another 50 minutes.
No, from the last one, I certainly went for a long time there.
No, you did. You did fine. You did fine. I'm sure our ratings will be fat, through the roof on it. Great, folks. Thanks so much for joining us again. Like I said, this... You know, Larry, I so much just appreciate your wisdom on how we've gone through this. And just to see that, you know, here's John using some symbolism of this great, of this number of the tribe. And then he looks and he sees a great multitude and how he's tying that all together and how he mixes in Jewish tradition and Jewish views. And but that was just good stuff. Folks, we're so happy that you're with us. You can always find the latest podcast on apocalary.ca. And one day I will get off my behind and we'll actually have a feed up on iTunes. And you can grab it from there too. Or Apple Podcasts, Google Play. I don't know. I don't even know how to do that yet. So if I read about it, you know, maybe I'll Google how to get on Google Play. That would be ironic, wouldn't it? We'll go from there. But until next time, thanks so much for joining us. And we'll see you on the next episode of Apocalary.
Good night, everybody.